Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 86 called The Sack of Antioch. In the last episode, we left Belisarius in Constantinople, having returned from Italy to face the growing threat from Persia. But by the time he arrived back in the capital in late 540, it was already too late. Cosroes had inflicted the worst defeat on the Romans since the 3rd century AD, when the Shah Shapur had defeated and captured the Emperor Valerian. This time, Cosroes had completely destroyed Antioch. It was the second city of the empire, home to over 100,000 people. He razed it to the ground and killed or enslaved most of its population. The overriding question is, just how did such a catastrophe happen, especially when Justinian's Rome was supposedly at the height of its power? So let's start at the beginning. If you recall from episode 78, in 532, Justinian had signed the so-called Eternal Peace, a humiliating treaty, in my view, for which he paid the Persians 11,000 pounds of gold. Some historians see it as a far-sighted plan to free up troops for the reconquest of the West. But I think that was just part of the reason. I suggest it was also a knee-jerk reaction to the Nika riots that nearly toppled him from power. Justinian knew any defeat inflicted by the Shah Cavad would be the final straw and seal his fate. So he welcomed peace at almost any cost. According to Procopius, Cavad's successor, Cosroes, spent the years of the Eternal Peace strengthening his own internal position. A major weakness of the Persian monarchy in the 5th and early 6th centuries had been the power of the Persian nobles. But in the 8 years in which the peace lasted, Cosroes worked on breaking their power. To do this, he reformed the provincial administration. Persia was divided into 4 provinces, governed by a Marsban, who had the title of a king. They were powerful enough to challenge the Shah himself and could act as kingmakers or breakers. Cosroes undermined their authority by appointing an additional layer of administration with military governors called sparbeds and civil governors called padospans. The sparbeds were given the highest authority and reported directly to the Shah. They could even overrule the Marsbans. Cosroes therefore played off the nobles against each other by appointing his favourites into the positions of sparbed. It was essentially a return to the original Sasanian state, set up by Ardashir and his son Shapur back in the 3rd century AD, before the nobility curbed monarchical power. It's also worth noting that some historians believe the reforms were begun by Cosroes' father Cavad, and they were so effective that the Arabs even maintained them after they destroyed the Persian Empire in the 7th century. Another important reason why Persia became more of a threat to Rome in the 6th century was the decline of the power of the White Huns, often referred to as the Hephthalites in this period, who were their ruling dynasty at that time. In the 5th century, they'd achieved what Attila failed to do with the Roman Empire. They actually overran Persia and reduced it to a tributary status after defeating and killing the Persian Shah Peroz in 484. Unfortunately, very little is known about this period. The Roman sources provide no insights whatsoever, but a 9th century Persian source suggests that after subjugating Persia and demanding annual tribute from it, the White Huns shifted their focus eastwards towards Afghanistan and China. Indeed, after installing Cavad on the throne, they lost interest in Persia, which by the time of Cosroes' rule was mostly independent of them. So let's return to the Roman sources, and there's no surprise our friend Procopius provides us with the best account of Chosroes' second war with Rome, which lasted 5 years, from 540 to 545. He tells us it was a mix of Chosroes' fear and jealousy of Justinian's success in the West that caused him to terminate the eternal peace. Embassies from both the Armenians and the Goths urged him to wage war on Justinian before it was too late and he'd conquered so much territory that he became invincible. An Armenian embassy warned the Shah specifically of Justinian's ambition. Thus, quote, "The whole earth is not large enough for the man. It is too small a thing for him to conquer all people together. But he's even looking in the heavens and searching in the nooks and crannies beyond the great ocean, wishing to gain for himself some other world." End quote. In 539, as Belisarius closed in on Ravenna, as I mentioned in the last episode, a Gothic embassy also pleaded with Chosroes to attack Rome. But Chosroes didn't need much persuading. By 539, he was preparing the army for war. Procopius says he instructed Almundia, the leader of the pro-Persian Arab Lakhmids, to make up any complaint he could think of to break the peace. Almundia complied by claiming the pro-Roman Arab Ghassanids had invaded their land. Procopius tells us the land in question, situated to the south of Petra in modern Jordan, was worthless, but it still served as a pretext for war. Chosroes added two more reasons to break the peace. One was that Justinian was conspiring to persuade the Huns in the Caucasus to attack Persia, and there may well have been some truth in that. The other was from the Armenians, who begged the Persian Shah to intervene to stop the Romans from overtaxing them, which again was probably true, since Justinian's overzealous tax strategy had a habit of backfiring on him. Ignoring Justinian's pleas for peace, in the spring of 540, although we don't know the exact date, Chosroes marched west with a large army. Despite clear evidence war was brewing, Justinian had conspicuously failed to strengthen the Roman army in Mesopotamia. Indeed, he'd done the exact opposite. Not only were the best troops in Italy with Belisarius, but in keeping with his policy of cutting military expenditure, he hadn't even paid some of the lower quality garrison troops on the eastern frontier, the so-called Limitanei. For example, in 539, we know that the garrison of the key Roman fortress of Dara, opposite the equally important Persian fortress of Nisibis, mutinied because they hadn't been paid. In The Secret History, Procopius emphasizes the disastrous consequences of Justinian's penny pinching. It's a subject I'll return to in a future episode, but the main point I would make now is that if Justinian had been diverting these resources into a worthwhile project, that would have been fine. But my suspicion is he was funding his vanity projects, such as his building bonanza, of which Hagia Sophia was, of course, the main prize. When Chosroes marched into Roman territory, he played a cunning game. He didn't head for the normal Persian target of Dara, close, as I mentioned, to the Persian fortress of Nisibis, where Belisarius had defeated him in 531. Instead, he followed the course of the Euphrates, about 200 miles south of Dara, into the heart of Syria. There was no Roman army there to meet him. The towns were garrisoned, but the field army troops were in Italy and North Africa. Justinian had been caught out. Chosroes marched fast into the Roman interior. None of our sources say whether Antioch was his aim right from the beginning, but he was certainly going in the right direction to reach the empire's second most important city. He avoided the city of Callinicum, where Belisarius had suffered his only defeat, and stopped instead at the town of Sura. Procopius says he chose Sura because as he passed it, his horse neighed and stamped the ground, which the magi, that is the Persian priests, thought indicated it would easily fall. But the magi weren't entirely right. The first Persian assault was beaten back with heavy losses, although the Roman commander Arsaces, a brave soldier who led the defence and killed many Persians himself, was struck by an arrow and died. This panicked the inhabitants, who begged their bishop to go to Chosroes and plead for their lives if they paid a large enough ransom. When the bishop threw himself at the Shah's feet, Chosroes concealed his anger at the losses his men had suffered and said he would happily comply with their request. But in reality, he was preparing a trap to take the town by storm. A ransom sum was agreed, and the bishop returned in jubilant mood, surrounded by Persian nobles who accompanied him to the town gate. Behind them came an advance guard of the Persian army. The town's inhabitants watched the bishop and Persians embracing outside the gate, and in their joy at seeing what they thought was a peaceful solution, they opened the gate to let the bishop back in. Immediately, the Persians threw a block of wood into the gateway and stopped it from shutting as hundreds of soldiers rushed in. The Persian army stormed the town, burnt it to the ground, and enslaved all its inhabitants, about 12,000 of them. Procopius says it could have been worse had Chosroes not taken a liking to a pretty young captive called Euphemia, who he added to his many wives, and at her request spared the inhabitants' lives. But the message was simple. Resist at your peril. There was now panic across Syria. The Eastern Field Army was mainly in the west. There were only unpaid limitanei to resist the Persians. Chosroes led his army towards Hierapolis, a large and strongly walled city on the road to Antioch. In Belisarius's absence, who was at that moment sailing back to Constantinople to take charge of the situation in the east, Buzes was the Roman commander-in-chief and was stationed at Hierapolis with what little existed of the Eastern Field Army. We have no idea of its exact size, but we can be sure it was a small force, probably no more than a few thousand strong, having been severely depleted by troop withdrawals to the west. Procopius accuses Buzes of cowardice, saying he told the people of Hierapolis it would be better for him and his troops to remain outside the walls where they could harry the Persians. He then literally disappeared, according to Procopius. Quote, he chose the best part of the Roman army and was off. Where in the world he was, neither any of the Romans in Hierapolis nor the hostile army was able to learn, end quote. Indeed, Buzes fled so far away that he completely disappears from the rest of our story. Not so another Roman commander, Justinian's cousin, Germanus, who had recently returned from Africa, where he'd put down the army of occupation's mutiny, as you heard in episode 81. Justinian had dispatched him post-haste from Constantinople to Antioch to take command of the defence of the city. But there was one problem. He only had 300 soldiers with him. Nevertheless, Germanus was a capable commander and immediately set about reviewing the city's defences. Although these were large and extended all around the city, which was also helpfully bordered by the Orontes River in several places, he identified one weak point. This was on the northern side of the city, where the ground rose steeply into the foothills of Mount Silpius, and there was a large rocky outcrop at almost the same level as that section of the walls themselves. Alarmingly, this provided a natural platform as good as any siege tower. This deficiency was probably because Antioch had suffered two savage earthquakes in 526 and 528, and the wall hadn't been subsequently repaired up to its original height. Germanus decided there was no time to build the walls higher or to extend them around the rocky outcrop, which might have been the best solution. Instead, he directed the citizens to build a wooden platform behind the walls so that a mass of defenders could oppose the Persians on the rock. Procopius says this was a mistake, and in his view, the defenders should have occupied the rock and tried to defend it. But Germanus was no fool. He knew the city's defences were too weak. He urgently called for reinforcements. In Butses's absence, the most he could summon were 6,000 Limitanii from Palestine, a not inconsiderable force, but nothing like the high-quality horse archers which had been mostly sent west. So, in desperation, he tried to buy Chosroes off. He knew the Persian kings valued tribute from the Romans almost more than victory in battle, so he sent an embassy to offer him peace terms, including a large ransom. Enter an important new character in our story. The leader of this embassy was the Bishop of Beroea, Megas. Megas was a conspicuously brave man. He met Chosroes in front of the walls of Hierapolis, which Chosroes was besieging. He offered him £2,000 of silver to leave the city and its surrounding countryside unmolested. He then offered the Persian king £1,000 of gold to abandon his entire campaign and depart from Roman territory. Chosroes was tempted. He seems to have been in two minds whether to sack Roman cities or extract plunder from them. With Hierapolis, fortunately for its inhabitants, he chose the latter and accepted Megas's offer and left it alone. Megas then returned to Antioch to find the gold to pay him to abandon his campaign completely. And the entire campaign might have ended there. Chosroes seemed to like Megas and trusted him, a little like Attila is said to have done when confronted by Pope Leo when he was on a similar mission to save Rome in 452. Would Chosroes have kept to his word? Procopius seems unsure. Quote, "He was the cleverest of all men at speaking untruths, concealing the truth and blaming his victims for his own crimes. He was also ready to agree to everything and ratify the agreement with an oath, yet much more ready to completely forget what he'd just agreed and sworn." End quote. But whatever Chosroes' true intentions, it was Justinian who scuppered any hope for peace when his embassy arrived in Antioch to convey the unhelpful message the emperor wouldn't accept a ransom paid to the Persians. His instructions were to resist. This infuriated Germanus, who fell out with Justinian's embassy and not long afterwards left the city, clearly thinking it was a lost cause. Meanwhile, Chosroes was still waiting at Beroea for Megas to return. The inhabitants of the town had offered to pay the same ransom as that paid by Hierapolis, i.e. £2,000 of silver. Chosroes insisted on double that. The inhabitants said they simply didn't have the cash ready. So Chosroes prepared to assault the city. At night, its citizens retreated into the citadel. The next day, the Persians found the town deserted, only to be shot at by the defenders from the walls. When they tried to storm the citadel, they were beaten off with heavy losses. But the Beroians had made a mistake. They'd taken all their livestock into the citadel, who drank the water well dry. Within a few days, they were so thirsty they could see no hope but to surrender. Just at that moment, the plucky Megas arrived back from Antioch. He found Chosroes furious. His 1,000 pounds of gold ransom money wasn't forthcoming. But Megas was far braver than any of the Roman commanders. He stood up to Chosroes and boldly protested the Persian king had also not kept to his side of the bargain by attacking Beroia while he was away. Procopius describes a vivid and heated exchange between the two of them. Chosroes could have had Megas beheaded at any moment, but Megas lay on the ground and pleaded with the Shah to allow his townspeople to go free if they gave him all the money they could spare. When he wept for his people and told Chosroes it did not befit such a great king to kill innocent people, Chosroes relented. The King of Kings respected a brave man when he met one. He said they could all go free and called Megas his friend. Unfortunately, at this point, Megas exits from our story and we never hear of him again. But his bravery stands in stark contrast to the cowardly behaviour of the Roman high command. Back in Antioch, the commander-in-chief of the Eastern Army, Bootses, had disappeared, and the city's new governor, Germanus, had fled the city. The road to Antioch lay open. Chosroes advanced right up to the city walls where its inhabitants were crowded. His ambassador, Paulus, a highly regarded diplomat, fluent in many languages, offered to leave them unharmed in return for a ransom of 1,000 pounds of gold. Chosroes expected them to beg for mercy, but in a strange display of almost childish petulance, they did the opposite. Procopius tells us, quote, "The inhabitants of Antioch are not serious people, but always engaged in disorderly jesting, and they heaped insults upon Chosroes from the battlements and taunted him with unseemly laughter," end quote. They even took potshots at Paulus, his respected ambassador. Chosroes was a proud man. Boiling with anger, according to Procopius, he decided to spare no one. The Persian assault didn't last long. As Germanus had predicted, they broke through at the weak point in the walls beside Mount Silpius. The wooden platform, constructed to allow more defenders to resist the Persians, simply collapsed under their weight. Once the Persians were inside the walls, the 6,000 Limitanii conducted a well-executed retreat through the south gate, which I suspect they had rehearsed in anticipation of a Persian breakthrough. Most of them escaped, although Procopius says they trampled thousands of fleeing citizens to death as they went. The city was at the mercy of the Persians, but they didn't show much mercy. They advanced down the ancient streets, killing all before them. The bravest of the defenders were the young men of the blue and green factions. They were the ones who'd hurled insults at Chosroes. Now they lined the streets and, quote, "Some of them were in heavy armour, but the majority were unarmed, using only stones as missiles. Pushing back the enemy, they raised the paean," which was the Roman war cry, "and with shouts proclaimed the Emperor Justinian triumphant, as if they'd won a victory," end quote. But their heroism was to no avail. They were slaughtered in their thousands. The streets of Antioch ran red with blood. Procopius says the Persians killed all they came across, young or old, male or female, and women threw themselves into the Orontes River to avoid being raped. Some inhabitants did escape with the retreating Limitanii, but most were killed or enslaved. There's no reliable source for the numbers that died that day, but it must have been well over 50,000. Khosroes ordered the city to be burnt to the ground, except for its cathedral. Then he sent messengers to Justinian, saying he wanted not 1,000 pounds of gold to halt his offensive, but 5,000. And to celebrate his glorious victory, he did what no Persian Shah had done for nearly 300 years. He went to swim in the Mediterranean Sea. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And in the next episode, which will be in a week's time on the 4th of May, we'll continue with the amazing story of the age of Justinian. And in the meantime, if you like the podcast and listen to it on Spotify, I'd be so grateful if you could click the star rating. That would be fantastic. And of course, do also check out my website, nickholmesauthor.com, link in the show notes, to find maps, blogs, and a free ebook. And don't forget to take a look at my latest book, Rome and Attila. Again, link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.